From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Dale Thronberry.
And good morning, America, and welcome to Veterans Radio, coming to you live from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, WDEO 990 AM. It's another beautiful, snowy morning here in Michigan. I think it's the first day of February. We're waiting for the groundhog to come out tomorrow from Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. So we're excited to have you on the program today. We're going to be talking a lot about a lot of different things. Mainly, we're going to be talking about jobs, and leadership, and I'm very excited to have everybody in the control room. We've got Nina on our board. We've got Maria running our social media. You can contact us at on Facebook at Veterans Radio and also on Twitter at Veterans Radio, and she's going to be tweeting throughout the program, letting you know what is going on. And I'm going to want to have a little contest for you out there today. We're trying to figure out how far Veterans Radio reaches out into the community and around the world. So I've got books available to you from our second guest today, Rebecca Becky Halstead. She's written a really great motivational book called The First Person You Must Lead Is You. And so I want you to contact us here at Veterans Radio. You can give us a call at 877-573-7825, 877-573-7825. And whoever is listening to Veterans Radio the farthest away on our radio station, terrestrial radio, will get you a free copy of the book, and also where you are if you're listening on the internet, and we will also get you a copy of that book. So we'll announce our winners at the end of the program. But right now, our first guest on Veterans Radio happens to be the executive director of the Penn Mutual Center for Veterans Affairs at the American College, and his name is Ted Diggs. And Ted Diggs is a retired U.S. Navy captain, and he is the executive director. And, Ted, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Dale, thanks for having me on. It's good to be here.
So what's going on in Philadelphia today?
Well, it is still cold, and, yeah, we are anxiously looking forward to Groundhog Day as well.
What is it when he sees his shadow at six more weeks or if he doesn't see his shadow at six more weeks? I can't remember now.
50-50-90. I'm not sure.
All right. Well, anyway, so I found out about your program for veterans transitions through the internet, and somebody had sent me an email saying, hey, you got to check into this program. So could you tell us about how the American College and Penn Mutual partnered up to offer this new program to veterans?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, the American College is it's 87 years old. It's been around for it's got quite a history, and it specializes in the financial services industry. So it's not your typical 4-year undergraduate degree. It actually gives designations and certifications for the financial services, insurance industry, leadership, those kinds of things. And about 25% of the industry has a designation from the American College, so it's kind of the 800-pound gorilla in the industry.
Right. Yeah, I remember that because I was in insurance for a long time, and everybody said, "Oh, you got to take the CLU classes and so on and so forth." So it has a great reputation especially among insurance professionals.
Absolutely. So the American College was very interested in looking at ways to support veterans, and so they approached Penn Mutual with this idea. And Penn Mutual they got very excited about it as well. So they're on board. So about 2.5 years ago, Penn Mutual, through a very generous grant, allowed the center to stand up and become into existence. And since that time, so they've got the branding name. It's within the American College. But since that time, we've had additional donors come in. So we give out scholarships under the auspices of the Penn Mutual Center, but it could be a scholarship from other financial services organizations, because there are a lot of organizations out there that are very interested in supporting veterans in the financial services, not only for folks that have been successful that were veterans, but also those that are interested in bringing in the kind of experience that the veterans have into the industry.
And what does a veteran have to do to get involved in this?
Well, it's actually pretty easy because from the scholarship aspect, we're pretty well funded to give out scholarships to active duty, to the spouses, and to recently transitioned veterans. So if somebody's transitioned within the last 5 years or so, or they're on active duty and they're thinking about transitioning, those are the folks that we want to get interested. And the other thing is we really look at the veteran as a whole family unit, because as they're transitioning, which is a very exciting and nerve-wracking time as you're leaving the service, we recognize that it's not just the service member that is sometimes looking for a job or can support the family, but also the spouse. So we offer the scholarships for spouses as well.
And how much, I guess you could say, how much money is available for these scholarships? I mean, what would it cost for somebody to go for their chartered life underwriter designation normally through the American College?
Well, as you probably imagine, there's over a dozen different designations you get, and some of them are in the insurance industry, some from financial services, and some are we actually give out two master's degrees as well.
Right.
So the cost varies, and so for the example that you use, it's probably about say $6,000-$7,000. And so that's a full scholarship. The master's could be as high as $20,000, and all of our scholarships are full scholarships.
That is great to know. Can you tell me real briefly, I was just thinking about that as I was going through my notes, that the American College was founded by a gentleman from the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. You can't get much more business-oriented than the Wharton School.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. Another fine Pennsylvania institution.
Yes, and so just an idea to let people know that this organization, the American College, is the the pinnacle as far as training goes for industry professionals from the insurance and financial services organization. They're always recommending that when you're talking to a financial professional that they should have additional training other than just getting their license through the state.
Absolutely. The other thing that is important to point out is that if someone's on active duty and they start taking these courses, and it's all primarily distance learning online via CDs, books, that kind of thing, and if they get a designation prior to getting out, they really become a hot commodity, because not only do they have their credentials from what they've learned and their experience in the service, but now they've got an industry-recognized designation, and that really makes them a hot commodity. In fact, the other thing we do, Dale, is not just offer the scholarships. That's really the crown jewel, but we also do placement. So if there's a lot of industries that are very interested in these folks, so we can match them up where they want to be, what kind of industry, and help them find a job as well.
Well, we're talking with Ted Diggs, who's the executive director of the Penn Mutual Center for Veterans Affairs at the American College. And we're trying to get our veterans, new careers when they get out. So how would they get more information about this, Ted?
Well, the primary way we like to folks, our gateway is the website. And that's www.theamericancollege, that's all one word, theamericancollege.edu, and then /PMCVA. That's Penn Mutual Center for Veterans Affairs. So, yeah, theamericancollege.edu /PMCVA.
All right. So theamericancollege.edu/PMCVA. You can get all the information that you're looking for there on their website. I believe I've got the link on our page. If you go to theveteransradio.net right there, you just click on a little picture that I put up there, and I put a link to their website on that. I think this is a great, great opportunity for veterans, male and female, young and old. It's a great career to be in. I know there are many, many of my friends have many of these designations, and they're doing very, very well. So, Ted, I want to thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio.
Dale, thanks so much for having me.
It was
have a great weekend.
All right. It was our pleasure. This is really exciting, folks. Many, many corporations out there, as we've talked about before here on Veterans Radio, are offering programs to veterans transition programs, and so forth. And this is another one. I mean, full scholarships, anywhere from $6,000 to $20,000, $20,000 to get a master's degree in finance. My financial advisor has got so many designations after his name, it's like a doctor. But, it shows that the continuing education, because this is a field that is constantly evolving, and it's another way. You know, let me back off here, a little political statement here on my own. These are the people that you can trust because they've gotten the extra education and the training to help you with your financial needs. So look out there for all those people with a certified financial planner or chartered life underwriter or chartered health underwriter, all these different things from the American College. This is a great opportunity. So we're hoping that people will go there and look at the americancollege.edu/PennMutual Center for Veterans Affairs, PMCVA. Great opportunity. We'll be right back with our next guest, General Rebecca Halstead, Brigadier General, United States Army, retired. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And we're back on Veterans Radio listening to John Philip Sousa's West Point March, and I'm sure that our guest hasn't heard that very often. But right now we want to welcome to Veterans Radio retired Brigadier General Rebecca Becky Halstead. Let me give you some information about her. She graduated from the United States Military Academy in 1981 with the second graduating class to include women, and she had the honor of becoming the first woman graduate in West Point history to achieve promotion to general officer. Not only was she the first woman in her class to become a general, she was the first person in her class, male or female, to be promoted to general. She was also the first woman in U.S. history to serve as a commanding general in combat. Whew. And she's done so much more. So we're so excited to have our guest today, General Becky Halstead. Welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you very much, Dale. I really appreciate the opportunity to be with you this morning.
You're quite the young woman, aren't you?
Well, I like that you said young. Between that and John Philip Sousa, I'm feeling really good this morning.
I figured that you would like that. We're trying to find some other things for you, too, as we go along. Well, this, of course, you when you first started at West Point, you were only in the second class of women that were enrolled there. Can you tell me how you got to West Point? Tell me a little bit about your background of growing up in New York.
Well, that's correct. I was in the second class of women starting in 1977. In 1976, when they were opening up the academies to women and announcing, you know, the new policy, I was a junior in high school. My dad was an IBMer, and my mother was a dental hygienist, and I was one of four kids. And I was very active in sports, and I was very determined to go to Ithaca College and become a physical education teacher and coach. And one night, my mother was reading in the newspaper that they're letting women go into the academies. And as she read the article, she said, "I think this sounds just like you." And I looked around the room, and there were no other people in the room but me. And I said, "That sounds like me." She goes, "Yes, I think it sounds just like you. You need to look into this." And I candidly thought my mother was quite crazy. I knew nothing about the military, only just a little bit of military in our family. So, you know, I told my mom, "Well, if you help me, you know, I'll take a look at it and, you know, write the letters and all that." But the more I learned about the academy, the more I thought, well, there's just no way I'll get accepted. But to please my mom, I went through the whole process. And then in March of my senior year, I got accepted by West Point, the United States Military Academy, to be in that second class. And I mean, I went from being very excited to being very scared in about 60 seconds.
I can understand that.
But I just couldn't, you know, I knew enough to know that I could not turn that opportunity down. You know, it was so much of it was unknown, but, you know, my gut instinct was really what an honor. And, you know, I didn't know what I didn't know, but I have a very strong faith, and I just don't believe that door would have been opened if it wasn't for all the right reasons. And so off I went to West Point in 1977, right after I graduated.
So, tell me a little bit about your introduction to West Point when you first got there.
Well, I tease often that, you know, even though I was in the second class, the summer of 77, you could still hear 200 years of perfectly good tradition crashing to the ground. You know, I mean, it was still, I think there was still a lot of hope in the air that, you know, this was a mistake and that the policy would be changed and they would, you know, not continue to let women come. I mean, there was just so much reluctance to it. But I must say that the superintendent of the United States Military Academy, Lieutenant General Andrew Goodpaster, was probably my first experience of seeing an incredible, humble, authentic, caring leader. I mean, I think there was a real reason they brought him out of retirement to take on what had to have been a very challenging position. I mean, I had not a clue when I was 18 years old what he really actually, in my mind, sacrificed. You know, I mean, he's already retired, you know, came back to active duty to do that. And I you know, the politics of it all, I just admire him completely. And I admired him from the eyes of an 18-year-old, but now as a retired general myself, I admire him even more for taking that on. But you know, it was very difficult, and for good reason. I mean, we want our military academies to be hard, you know, because we're graduating young men and women who are going to go out and lead America's sons and daughters. So we want it to be a tough curriculum. We want it to be a tough environment, and we want to make sure that we are graduating the best. But I don't think I had a clue how hard it was really going to be until I got there. And, you know, and the whole first year, you're allowed four answers: yes, sir, no, sir, no excuse, sir, and sir, I do not understand. And that's it for 12 months.
That's all you can say, right?
I'm sorry?
That's all you can say, right?
Yeah, right. Unless they give you permission to say more, those are your standard answers. And, you know, it's just, so the essence of it is that you enter through those doors, and to a degree they take away, you know, the identity that you knew.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of break all that away, and then they start to build in you a very strong character and competence that is required of being in the military. And we all come there from different backgrounds. You know, I was very blessed. I came from a very strong, disciplined, faith-based background. You know, I went to West Point with discipline. But I learned even more about discipline while I was there. But there are others who come, and I don't think they have the same foundation. So you can understand the need for that structure and for that environment in order to ensure that we're building, you know, core officers with a great sense of service and to country and character and, you know, being part of a bigger team. So it all makes sense, but making sense doesn't make it easy.
No, it doesn't. We're talking with retired General Rebecca Becky Halstead of the United States Army, member of only the second class to allow women through West Point on, and we're going to be talking about her book in just a little bit. I wanted to ask you a little bit about, you know, you mentioned, I think it was your family code was where I read that. Probably a lot of people that came in through your that first year class, you know, didn't make it all through all 4 years, did they?
Oh, absolutely not, right. The attrition rate, we West Point was on a model of it was called an attrition model. And so it was expected based on the number of acceptance letters that went out and the number of people that would accept their seat at West Point, that 40% of all who entered the first year would not graduate. And that's about what we had. We had 103 women in my class, and 104 women, and graduated 63. And we had about the same for the men in terms of 40%. So we, I don't know, we had 900 and something, and we had a 40% attrition with them as well. So it was pretty even amongst the men and the women. But so like the first night that I got to West Point, I stayed with three other women who were going to be new cadets in my class. And, you know, we were so different. You know, one gal was really interested in politics. One gal, she really wanted to be an astronaut when she graduated from West Point. And the other girl, I'm not sure, she liked to party that night, the night before. And you know, and I read all the information that West Point sent us, and one of the things they said was get a good night's sleep the night before your first day because it's going to be a rough day, probably the roughest day you've ever had in your young life. So I was ready to go to bed, get a good night's sleep, and take that next day charging. And these three gals, I mean, they just, you know, they were just chatting all night and in and out of the room. And I was just so frustrated that the next morning I went to my parents' hotel room and said, okay, we're out of here. Let's go. And my mother said, what do you mean we're out of here? I mean, it's too early to go, you know, go get on the buses. I said, no, we're going home.
Oh.
And my mother goes, we're going home. You can't quit. And my parents had two rules. Rule number one, don't quit. Rule number two, refer back to rule number one. And so I said, well, I haven't officially started, so I don't think it would be considered quitting, you know. And my mother said, well, you know, why are you so frustrated? I explained it to her. She said, let's just drive around West Point for a while, and let's just think about this, and you have to at least try. And so, of course, obviously I did and got on the bus and went up to the football stadium. And one of the last things they said to us before they separated us from our parents was, take a look to your left and a look to your right. Three out of every four of you new cadets will not be here on graduation day. And if you fast forward four years later on graduation day, I was the only one in that room of four women that night that graduated. And, you know, so there's a lot of truth to that, I guess.
I think there really is. I think I'm just sitting here laughing to myself, thinking of all the times I heard those lines, look to your left, look to your right. These people aren't going to be here when you're done with whatever class you were in and so forth. And it's pretty interesting. And I love the line. I'm glad that you mentioned it about your family philosophy of, you know, your option of failures are zero. And
right.
To refer
back. You know, I was very blessed because my parents, you know, so many people go like, oh, my gosh, you know, being a woman, I mean, what made you think you could do that? And I said, well, because I've always grown up believing that, you know, you can do anything you set your mind out to, that, you know, in my heart and my mind are, you know, if you put my brain and my heart out on a table, you don't know whether that's male or female. And
right.
So I think, you know, succeeding in life comes from the inside. And yes, you know, being female it can be a distractor initially when, you know, because people judge you from the outside. But if you live based on your character and your confidence and you lead your life that way, you know, then I think people will start to see that come through and they begin to ignore the fact that you're, you know, male versus female. And, you know, as I wrote in the book, you know, leadership is the fusion of heart and mind. It is those two things working together to make the best choices in your life and to, you know, I always laugh because I do a lot of public speaking. I speak on leadership in the corporate sector and at colleges and everything else. And I'll say, well, how many of you, you know, have children? And, of course, most of the people in the corporate sector, you know, they have children. I said, oh, how many of you struggle when your child does something wrong? You know, your mind says, you're grounded for life, you know, but your heart says, oh, this is my firstborn child. I love this
right.
child. And you start getting all, you know. I said, I'm just here to encourage you that struggle is good because the struggle between your heart and mind will help you make the best decisions. And so many people think that if they're struggling between their heart and their mind, that they're weak, that they're indecisive. And I don't believe that to be true.
I want to remind our audience that we're talking with Rebecca Becky Halstead, Brigadier General of the United States Army, retired, who's written a great motivational book, I think, called The First Person You Must Lead Is You. And I want to remind our listeners out there that we've got copies of these to give away. So if we hear from you and you are the furthest listener, either listening on our broadcast stations or on the Internet, we're going to be able to get you a copy out there. If you have any questions, make sure that you give us a call here at Veterans Radio at 877-573-7825. 877-573-7825. Well, Becky, I want to find out, you know, we know that you made it through West Point. I can only imagine the challenge of going through that school. And when I was a kid, we would go up to West Point all the time on school trips and so forth. And I was always just so in awe of the buildings, the grounds, just the place. You know, so much history there. And, of course, when I was growing up, was you know, mid-century, as they call it now, that, you know, Army and Navy and so forth had the best football teams and, you know, Heisman Trophy winners and all those other things. So they were in the news all the time. And anybody that graduated from the academies, they were, you know, a step above everybody else. And
right.
I want to congratulate you just for making it through there.
Thank you. I mean, I think that since you've been there, you know that when you walk the grounds of West Point, you know, you can almost you have a sense of who has walked there before you, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's what really kept me there. You know, when I would have really rough days, I would go out and I'd sit on the granite bench, you know, overlooking the Hudson River at Trophy Point. You know, I always chose the one that had the word discipline, you know, etched into it. And and you know, you sit there and I would think about the greats of our nation that went to West Point. And I would think about the fact that, well, while they were going through West Point, they were just young men.
Mm-hmm.
They were young adult, just like I was a young adult, struggling. You know, I mean, Patton struggled with his academics. You know, Eisenhower struggled with, you know, wanting to see his girlfriend and trying to sneak out and figure out how to do that. I mean, we all have different struggles. And it kind of put it in perspective for me that I needed to have this struggle at West Point in order to prepare myself for what the journey that lay ahead. And there's just so much rich history there that when you visit West Point, you can't help but feel it. You know, we call it the long gray line, and we think of those greats as the ghosts of the great Americans that went ahead of us. But in reality, those great men really motivated me to dig deep and be disciplined enough to stay there.
I just anybody who ever gets near West Point up the Hudson River from New York City, just go. I strongly encourage you to do that. It's such a history lesson that you could never learn enough about the men and probably now women that are honored there.
Right. And you're right about it being a history lesson because that was a pivotal point for the Revolutionary War.
Yep, I remember.
And, you know, your life has just changed forever. I speak, we have a lot of, there's a Thayer Leader Development Group now at the Hotel Thayer there that's a, we focus on doing leadership training for the corporate sector. So it's a wonderful leadership center. And one of the things we do is we take those corporations, those teams, and we take them on a staff ride of West Point, and we have them role play, you know, George Washington and then his commanders and how the Hudson River was that pivotal point. And, again, you're just kind of reliving history, and it's very exciting.
I agree. I think when next time I'm back home, I'm going to go back up there again just for the fun of it.
Well, good. I hope you do.
I think it would work like that. All right, so now we've graduated from West Point. You are a brand new second lieutenant, and we all know the respect that second lieutenants are held in regard, especially by senior enlisted men and women. So tell us where you went from there.
So my first duty assignment was in Vicenza, Italy. My branch that I chose was Ordnance Branch, and within the Ordnance Branch in those days, in the 70s, you had three different choices: ammunition, maintenance, and then what we called special weapons. So we had a nuclear duty positions. So when I went to Italy, my first job was in the special weapons arena where we maintained and stored nuclear weapons. And so there was at that time only one other woman in my unit. We also were teamed up with the Italian infantry for security, and we also had the Carabinieri, the Italian police, as part of our mission at a remote site there in Italy. But the bottom line is, Italy was so wonderful, a great place for a young second lieutenant to go. And even being at a remote site was still great, because when you weren't working, you could enjoy, seeing Italy. But my first platoon sergeant, you're taught that you and your platoon sergeant, you are battle buddies, you are a team, and it is mm-hmm. together that you will bring success to your platoon. And we're also taught that when you first show up, you better make sure that you spend the first 30 days learning as much as you can from that platoon sergeant, and then making it clear that, you're the lieutenant and you're in charge, but that you're a team. So, I showed up, and my platoon sergeant had more years in the Army than I had in life. He was a Vietnam veteran. He was a seasoned non-commissioned officer. And so I did what I was supposed to do with that first 30 days. But I will tell you, it was miserable. I mean, I never saw a smile crack that man's face. He barely wanted to talk to me. It was just so obvious that he really did not want to be my platoon sergeant. So after the 30 days, I took him aside and I said, look, Sergeant, we need, and I would give his name because I know his name, but I don't use names in my book, and I tend not to do that because, I'm not trying to, I never want to bring negative
right.
Visibility or something to someone. This is about the situation, so I just say Sergeant. But
can you describe to our audience the size differential between you?
Right,
two?
Right. So I'm 5'1.5", and he was a good 6 foot, maybe 6'2". I've got a picture of him. I need to really take a look at that. And he's a tall, skinny. I call him a tall, skinny dude, and just face of stone. And so after a morning formation, I dismissed the platoon to go into the mess hall to eat breakfast, and I said, hey, Sergeant, We need to have a little chat. So let's just, walk with me. And we were kind of like on a street with a curb that was painted, and we had a bunch of rocks that we painted, because in those days that's what we did. And I said, come with me and let's just talk. And I said, look, things are just not right. And, it appears to me that, I came to this platoon and I had 3 strikes against me. And so he's looking down at me and I'm looking up at him, and I said, so what do you think those 3 strikes are? And, he kind of played the, I don't know. And I said, okay, well, the first one is that I'm a West Point grad, and there's nothing worse than seeing a West Point grad coming, and, because they know everything. And the second one is I'm another second lieutenant that you have to train, and you've trained so many second lieutenants, why another one? And then the third strike against me, and I stood up on this big rock, and then I looked at him eye to eye, and I said, is the fact that I am short. And, most people usually laugh when they hear that because everybody's expecting that the third strike, of course, is going to be that I'm a woman. But I've always tried to use humor to get through situations. But I've also always tried to make sure that I talk about the elephant in the room mm-hmm. because the relationships won't get any better if you don't go eye to eye and talk about what the problem is. And that was the first time I saw that man smile. I mean, he literally laughed. And so I got down off the rock and we started to talk, and we really became a very tight team. As a matter of fact, 90 days into the job, we passed a huge nuclear surety inspection, of which the unit was, unfortunately, had failed many times. And so we just became a great team. And I use that as an example of saying that, sometimes – you might not really be the problem, but you can take the right steps and initiative to make things work. If you always wait for somebody else, the elephant stays in the room.
Right.
So anyhow, it was a interesting time, and could have had different, could have gone another way, but I think it went the right way and it turned out fine. But I've done that all my life. I never worked for a woman. I've only worked for men. I so often, in my 27 years, and I moved 18 times, I was the only female battalion commander in the division in Hawaii. I was the only female brigade commander in the division in 10th Mountain. I was the only female commanding general in Iraq from 2005 to 2006. And, you know, I bring that up to you, but I will tell you that I didn't focus on that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I used to say, well, I was the only logistician in the room, right?
Right.
And, yes, initially I stick out like a sore thumb, but as people start to work with you and you earn their respect and you help them understand what you bring to the fight, they just stop looking at you as a 5 foot, 1.5 woman. They look at you as part of their team. And, you know, that I felt like that was part of my responsibility.
Well, you certainly were very successful at it. We were talking with Rebecca Becky Halstead, Brigadier General, United States Army, retired. And we're going to take a break right now, Becky, so just hold on. We're going to come back and talk about her book, The First Person You Must Lead Is You, listening to our audience out there. If you want to get a copy of this book, give us a call, 877-573-7825. We want to find out how far away you are from Ann Arbor, Michigan right now. We're going to be taking a break. We'll be right back after these brief messages.
You're listening to Veterans Radio live from our flagship station, WDEO 990 AM in Ann Arbor, Michigan, WMAX 1440 AM in Saginaw, Michigan, WDEO 98.5 FM in Naples, Florida, or find us online at AveMariaRadio.net.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. First Lieutenant Jack Jacobs, although seriously wounded, made repeated trips across an open rice paddy, evacuating wounded and their weapons. Details after this.
As a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, joining IAVA.org really helps in the transition home. It's a network of OIF and OEF vets like me who've got your back here, just like we did over there. That means when you need help navigating the GI Bill, we've got your back. And when you're dealing with the transition home, we've got your back. Or when you just want someone to share stories with, we've got your back. Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org. We've got your back.
Brought to you by IAVA and the Ad Council.
Jacob served as an assistant battalion advisor in Kien Phong Province, Republic of Vietnam. The battalion was advancing when it came under intense heavy machine gun and mortar fire. Jacobs called for and directed airstrikes on the enemy positions. Due to the intensity of the enemy fire and heavy casualties to the command group, including the company commander, the attack stopped and the friendly troops became disorganized. Wounded by mortar fragments, Jacobs assumed command of the company, ordered a withdrawal from the exposed position, and established a defensive perimeter. Despite heavy bleeding from head wounds that impaired his vision, Jacobs returned under intense fire to evacuate a seriously wounded advisor to safety, where he administered life-saving first aid. He then returned through heavy automatic weapons fire to evacuate the wounded company commander. Jacobs made repeated trips across the fire-swept open rice paddies, evacuating wounded and their weapons. On three separate occasions, Jacobs drove off Viet Cong squads who were searching for Allied wounded and weapons, single-handedly killing three and wounding several others. His actions saved the lives of a U.S. advisor and 13 Allied soldiers. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
And we are back on Veterans Radio, and I'm sorry that was not Mustang Sally, but I closest I could get to that. Our guest
that was,
on I really tried this morning. I couldn't find it.
That was great. Thanks for trying.
We're talking with Becky Halstead, a Brigadier General in the United States Army, retired, who's written a great motivational book, I think, entitled The First Person You Must Lead Is You. And we were talking with Becky before the break about her various assignments, and I guess we need to get back up to your most difficult and challenging assignment, which was going to Iraq. Can you talk a little bit about that one?
Yes, certainly. Well, first of all, I described that year of 2005 to 2006 as definitely the most challenging, but also the most rewarding, you know, to lead in combat and serve with America's, you know, finest is it's really very difficult to even put into words, but I try to share many of my soldiers' stories in the book. because I want those stories to live on. I want their, in some cases, their memory to live on. I mean, I feel very strongly that we owe that to their families. And, you know, in the book, I only used one name in the entire book, and that was Staff Sergeant, Sergeant Jim Lukowski, mm-hmm. and then his parents, Barbara and Jim. And I did that purposely so that he was killed in my unit, and he Silver Star recipient. But when I met his parents at a Gold Star family function in D.C., and I had been in touch with them, you know, out of Iraq, and he was just one of many of my soldiers, but I really connected with a couple of different families, this family in particular. And his mother made the comment to me, you know, Becky, I never worry about us forgetting, you know, about our son Jim, but I worry about our nation forgetting about the sacrifices of our men and women. And so, you know, it's kind of a turning point for me, and I said, well, I will promise you this. You know, I will never forget, and I will do my best, and when I'm speaking on leadership, when I write on leadership, that I incorporate their stories because, you know, I've learned in life, you know, Dale, there is absolutely nothing that I have ever experienced or achieved that I did by myself. There are always other people on the team that were part of that, and I think that was so true in Iraq. I also describe that year as, you know, my highest highs and my lowest lows. You know, clearly the lowest lows are when you lose your soldiers in combat.
Mm-hmm.
But the highest highs are when, you know, you go to visit a wounded soldier and, you know, and they still want to try to salute you. They still want to try to sit up in bed. They still want to get back to their team. It's just, you know, they want to make sure that their battle buddy gets, you know, credit for pulling them out of a burning vehicle. And I mean, they're just incredible human beings. And you know, I know the first person on the show there, Ted Diggs, and what he's doing to help find jobs for veterans.
Mm-hmm.
I speak often on that as well. And I just, our corporate sector needs to understand that what we as veterans bring to their companies in terms of leadership, in terms of discipline, in terms of commitment and determination, it's hard pressed to be found anywhere else because we've proven it, you know, on the battlefield for each other. And so, but anyhow, I do write a lot about that in the book. And you know, it was a daunting year. 20,000 soldiers in the command, 5,000 civilian contractors. We operated out of 55 different bases. We provided all the distribution of logistics for the force of 250,000 people there.
Wow.
You know, In some ways, when you think about it, it's almost overwhelming. And, you know, people ask me, how did I keep from being overwhelmed? And I said, well, because I always put faces on the data. I always put faces on the team. And I always knew that it wasn't just me alone out there commanding this huge unit. I had incredible brigade commanders and sergeant majors and battalion commanders and sergeant majors and over 200 company commanders and first sergeants and all of their sergeants who are leading their squads and convoys. And so, you know, as you know in the book, I talk about, you know, success is a team sport. And so, you know, where we get in trouble is if we think we are the only one that's capable and powerful enough to do something like that. I think we have to always remember where we came from, and we need to always remember that we have a whole team and layers of team members that are accomplishing the mission. And that's really what kept me from ever being overwhelmed during that particular year.
I'm just amazed at what you and what other generals and other senior officers are able to accomplish. I wish I had realized this when I was in the service instead of, you know, instead of getting angry at my leaders, understanding the work that they were doing and the, you know, the pressures that were on them to complete their mission, you know,
right.
as it came down. And, you know, your organization there in Iraq is bigger than probably any corporation, you know, in America today. I mean, 250,000 people you're responsible for and making sure that they had their bullets, their food, their medicine, and everything else on a timely basis is just incredible.
Right. Well, of course, the three-star, he was the one who actually, we should say, had the whole responsibility for the 250,000. My unit of 20,000 had responsibility to support all of them.
Right.
But we had to have that mentality that, well, in essence, that's our team, too, because if they don't get their food, if they don't get their fuel, you know, we moved 3.1 million gallons of fuel a day in Iraq, you know, and I mean, I remember, you know, I'll never forget, obviously, but, you know, I had 2 hours of battle updates in the morning, 2 hours of battle updates in the evening, and it was just an enormous amount of data to, you know, to listen to try to connect the dots in your head with, and, you know, and I remember sitting there and feeling so much pressure to make sure that I was listening hard, you know, and this is, I think, a leadership skill that we don't talk much about, but leaders have to listen hard because, you know, they're depending on my experience and my knowledge to perhaps hear or see something that nobody else saw and then give them guidance and wisdom so that we can prevent, you know, bad situation from happening, or if we're already in kind of a, you know, a spotty situation that we can get ourselves out of it and I can get them pointed in the right direction. You know, and when you're going 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you know, for an entire year, there were many times I thought, oh, my gosh, I hope I'm alert enough. You know, I hope I'm, you know, sharp enough. And trying to keep that all in perspective was a real challenge of itself. And that's another part of the book that I write about is personal battle rhythm. You know, you if you run yourself into the ground, you won't be sharp.
That's right.
You have to make sure that you figure out how to get that power nap or that, you know, that devotional in to regroup and get your spiritual fitness back in order. And, you know, and I think you probably noticed on the cover of the book, I have two dog tags. And one dog tag says 24 and the other dog tag says 7. And that, you know, it's actually part of the title of the book, but it doesn't matter because you can write either one of them in Amazon or Google and you'll get the book. But I wanted that 24/7 on the cover as somewhat of a subliminal message to people that leading your life is not something that you can turn on and off, or you can,
right.
But you should, right? I mean, you want to be prepared every day to make the best choices for your life because a better me is a better we. If I make the best choices for me, then that becomes the best choices for my family, for my community, for my team at work. So I had to have I really understood that better than ever during that year in Iraq because you have to figure out how to make it work, and you have to help your soldiers figure out how to make it work. And because otherwise you become the enemy.
Right.
You know, when you have
yes.
soldiers that fall asleep at the wheel and they run into the back end of another fuel tanker and it explodes and your soldiers die, who's the enemy, right? So
right.
It's a constant battle to make sure that we have this right.
I think it's incredible, and I've only got about 10 minutes to go. My goodness, time is going so fast. You were successful in Iraq, obviously. You come home. And you were put in charge of what? You were in charge of the ordnance school?
Right. You know, we have the different branches in the Army. The ordnance branch is the second largest branch in the Army. And so we have, you know, a couple hundred thousand people that are either an ordnance soldier, warrant officer, or commissioned officer. And it's when you become the chief of your branch, you're responsible for the training and leader development of, you know, all the coursework, all the school work that the National Guard, Reserve, and active duty go through. So, we have so many different skill sets. We do everything from maintaining weapons to maintaining vehicles. So, you know, over 30 different skill sets. So my last job in the Army was being in charge. It's kind of like being the dean of a college.
Mm-hmm.
So being in charge of that academic environment, bringing new soldiers into the Army and putting them into the ordnance branch, and then the professional development, you know, right up until, you know, colonel and general in terms of their pre-command courses and everything else. So, you know, it was a challenging job to say the least, just because of you know, the priority is on the fight, and so how do we become a great supporting effort to that? So, but a very important job and a very important environment. But and then I got ill. I was ill with chronic fibromyalgia, and so I retired to wrap my – I was only 49 years old, and my family, we have pretty good genes, and my one grandmother lived to be 100, and so my goal is to be 101 just to keep, you know, competitive. And so I was 49 years old, diagnosed with chronic fibromyalgia and in a pretty bad state, dependent on many prescription drugs to help keep me going. And so I decided to retire, figure it out, wrap my arms around it, and start this new journey. And it's just been an incredible new journey since then. And I've learned a lot about holistic care and chiropractic and whole food nutrition. And I actually spent a great deal of my time trying to introduce those things to our military and let them be part of our health care so that we can keep more people in the military and not lose talent, because we don't know how to treat them and don't know how to take care of them.
Right. It's fascinating. I need to get into your book, but I wanted to mention that you're talking about these alternative treatments that are available out there to our veterans coming home, as you mentioned, chiropractic and so forth. We had a gentleman on the program who was a survivor of Iwo Jima, and he is now probably close to 91, 92, and he is out doing training sessions in transcendental meditation.
Wow, isn't that great?
Yeah, he discovered it, he said, in his late 70s, and he finally was able to control his anger from World War II. He couldn't figure out why he was so mad all the time, but I digress on that. Let's talk about...
That's a beautiful point, you know, Dale. I mean, it's never too late to start, you know, and I really hope that's what people will see in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a couple people say that anybody who's suffering from PTS ought to read this book, because one of the problems with PTS is we're looking for everybody else to provide me a prescription, a resource, and that's okay, but the main effort has to be you.
Absolutely.
You got to lead yourself to do differently.
Let's talk about that. We got about 6 minutes to go. Let's start talking about steadfast leadership.
Okay.
How'd you make this transition from general to motivational speaker?
Well, again, in the military, because of being a commander and then my last duty position in the schoolhouse, I always took very seriously the leader development of my subordinates. And so I always put the leader development training programs, I always enjoyed shaping those myself. And as a woman general, I was asked to speak often, you know, for Women's History Month and everything else. So I had started to get a flavor for the fact that I enjoyed that sort of work in the military. After I spent my first year in retirement just getting well, I thought I would really like to do this sort of work, but I don't really know how to do it. I mean, I don't know how to get started, but, you know, let me just kind of put my name out there to different people and different, you know, I had a pretty good network of friends. And, you know, really it's all been by word of mouth, but since 2010, when I first started Steadfast Leadership in January 2010, I mean, it's six times the amount of people now hiring me as then. But what happens is somebody hears you, and then they pass on to somebody else in the corporate sector, you know, you need to get this person to come in and talk about leadership to your team. And then, of course, some of these corporations are quite large, and so, you know, when they like the message that you have, they just keep bringing you back, but to different places. You're like Procter & Gamble. I mean, I've just enjoyed doing probably a dozen different events for them. So I call it the gift that keeps on giving. It's just but it has to be because you're connecting with them and they like the message. And, you know, and I think where I've been really blessed is that, you know, I have very unique stories, and the stories prove the principles. And then the other piece to that is I would say that the majority of the people that walk up to me after I speak, they say, you know what, I not only want to be a better CEO, I just want to be a better person. And it was that's kind of what drove me to write the book, because I think from young adults all the way through, we can learn every single day to be a better version of ourselves. So steadfast leadership has just kind of grown into a you know, I'm a one-person company, but I do a tremendous amount of speaking in the corporate, the not-for-profit, and the academia environment.
Okay. We are talking with Becky Halstead, the author of The First Person You Must Lead Is You. She's a retired Brigadier General, 24/7. This is what you got to do. Tell me about the acronym STEADFAST.
Okay, so I started STEADFAST when I was a battalion commander. I thought we like acronyms in the Army, and I just wanted one word that my soldiers could remember the priorities that were important to me. And so it stood for soldiers and soldiering, training, excellence, attitude, discipline, friends, family, and faith, accountability, safety, and teamwork. If I forgot the D, it's discipline. I might have said that too fast.
Yeah.
And discipline is the number one important one. If you're disciplined, all the rest of those things come together. So I said, if you just remember the word steadfast, then you will always know what I think is most important for our team. Well, that took on a life of its own. People say, can I use that? Can I borrow it? I said, sure, you know, use it.
Yeah.
And I kept that for the rest of the time that I was in the military. At the same time I did that was when my call sign was Mustang 6, which that's why I got called Mustang Sally. And I discovered that men really have a hard time writing ma'am. I end up being mama in most emails. So I said, look, guys, let's make this easy. Just call me M6. And that, over time, became Motivator 6. So when I retired, and steadfast came from a Bible verse, 1 Corinthians 15:58, that just says, be steadfast. Be faithful. Be loyal. And so I said, you know what? That worked for all the years in the Army. I'm going to use it for my company. And then I just changed it up a little bit to meet the corporate sector. And it's on my website for the new version.
Yeah, I see that. Selfless service, trust and tenacity, encourage and embrace, attitude and approachability, discipline, of course, family, friends, and faith, accountability, standard setter, and teamwork.
Yes.
Got them all there. I can't tell you how much I think this book is going to actually help me. I was so happy to read it, first of all. And when I finished it, I said, it's an easy read, folks. It's really a good story. And there are many lessons that to be learned in here. And I just encourage all of you out there to read. I think it will help you become better. You know, all of these little things that we've used throughout our lives, not only just the steadfast. One of my principles is just the Boy Scout, you know, trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent thing, which, you know, you don't think 60 years later you're still going to remember that, but that goes through my head every day. It's kind of my daily lesson to myself. If you do these things, you are going to be happier and more successful.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. I mean, I get messages on Facebook, on email, through my website all the time from kids that, you know, I served with 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, now they're battalion commanders, brigade commanders, sergeant majors, and they, through a person, will always say, ma'am, you know, what I remember most is your steadfast leadership, is all your principles of steadfast leadership, and I still use them today. And, you know, and I don't take credit for that. I give God the credit for that because I really believe that's how it got planted on my heart, you know. But the fact that it's helping other people, that was the whole purpose of writing the book, is how can we help other people with it?
Well, Becky, I want to thank you so very much. We're out of time. We're going to have you back on again. It's Becky Halstead. Go to her website real quick when you get a chance and find this book. It's on our website also in the bookstore, and we'll do that and make sure that you can just read it, folks. I'm strongly encouraging you. Becky, thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Dale. I really appreciate it. You have a really blessed weekend.
You too. Till next time, you are dismissed.
All views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.